Elizabeth Legge is, I mean, there's some things to say. She's the associate professor in the fine art department at the University of Toronto. She's written extensively on Dada and Surrealism. She did her graduate work at the Courtauld, but I want to say that she is a huge, huge part of a revitalization of our artistic community in Toronto through her work at the university. And those of us who followed the fine art department at the University of Toronto know how different it is now than it was even 4 years ago, and Elizabeth has a huge, huge role to play in that. Elizabeth Legge.
Thank you, Matthew. He has to say nice things about me. We were at graduate school together. And I still have that Super 8 film, Matthew. Actually, if I stop there, you may wonder. Actually, it was a birthday party. Okay. I confess right now that I feel rather uncomfortably like Benjamin's angel of history, looking back at simultaneous cataclysms, because I'm situated at the end of this panel, and feel that I somehow have to incorporate all the rich observations of my predecessors on the panel, as well as those of the speakers of the past few days. I don't see how I can do that. Benjamin's angel, of course, is caught in a time zone paradox that should make him the patron saint of conferences. The time zone paradox is, of course, that he's always after while being at the same time. A second prefatory remark. I was really impressed by Vera Frankl's democratic ordering of her speakers by alphabetic order, and I was also impressed with Terry Atkinson's 7 points about his practice, which he thought might be 8. He wasn't certain. I actually have 9 in my notes. So equally, both democratically and arbitrarily, I thought I'd use 12 points, not steps, in our consideration of strategies for museums after modernism. And like Dot, I made some notes about terms that have recurred throughout the symposium. I may duplicate some, but that'll be the uncanny at work, and about things we did not touch upon. All point to problems or problematics, and then possibly to tactics, if not precisely recuperating a strategy. The symposium raised the matter of the canon versus situated knowledge, the permanent collection versus the temporary intervention or interruptive interrogation. The question has been raised of how one can sustain a temporary intervention. An interruption is not yet necessarily a conversation. I think Ken Lum's whited out archival box containing a bottle of white out is a pithy embodiment of that dilemma. Related to that point is that of the archive versus the anti-catalogue. How does the artist critic or even art historian intervene periodically without necessarily acknowledging the prestige of the dominant model of the museum object or the administrative habit that is being parodied? Such conceptual strategies may as much normalize and aggrandize as diminish their object. Also allied to the matter of the permanent versus is the matter of the permanent versus the temporary, the matter of the outside versus the inside, the matter of the voice versus voices. Yes, I know these are binary. If voice, then one authority, of course. Or more insidiously, the voice may just be the symptom or sound of the omnivorous mouth that absorbs all other voices within itself. That is what we have been hearing as the musealizing problem. The museum can absorb any destabilizing tactic or intervention of heterogeneity within itself perfectly well. Conversely, if voices, then still the problem of how many and whose and on whose terms. Will Art Spiegelman's Skinhead, for example, be allowed a voice? Allied to voices and to interventions is the matter of the distribution of editorial or administrative power, the matter of the institutional curator versus the freelance curator. and also versus the powerful international Biennale curator, who, according to some British leftist critiques, have been sucked into the power vacuum like a dust bunny. The problem of how to stage criticism, critique, or in Irit Rogoff's terms, of when and where to situate criticality, a recurrent word has been interrogation. This is an ambiguous term which could be proposed in its dual sense, especially as we sit under this bank of lights. It refers to the tactic of asking destabilizing, skeptical questions, but it also resonates with a military penal torture context. Who interrogates whom? Who gets to pose the rhetorical questions? Allied to this is the matter of assessing the public's performativity. How can we assess who the public is and what it wants? How can we decide which of their assumptions must be pandered to or subverted? Who decides what public is valuable and for what reasons? Should the museum reach into communities of new immigrants, or is this a form of manipulation and condescension? Is being public, after all, a private matter? There's the recurrent addressing of the ways that our museum's citizenship, civic responsibility, participation, civil rights, and so on, may be engaged by the museum and our actions within and without it. Is the museum then a democratic institution or private club? How does the museum educator address human rights, racism, sexism, exploitation of all kinds, especially because those things so often underpin the operations of the corporations that provide the funding? Is there a real possibility of being a kind of rising damp in the museum's foundations through educating or curating? Allied to this, of course, is the matter of funding altogether, the economic necessities that drive the museum, and that the effect of that on museum policy. How do private collectors interact with and benefit from the museum, for example? An extreme case that I suppose most of us are aware of was the case of Charles Saatchi's curating and financing and generally managing of the image of his own collection of YBA art at the Royal Academy and then at the Brooklyn Museum. That exhibition itself provoked a conference on the ethics of museums. I don't know if Matthew was there. There has been here, I didn't mean it that way. I thought he would give us some extra insight. Hey, Matthew, Elizabeth, were you at WG?
Elizabeth forgot that I get the last word as the moderator. That's the problem.
Okay, you're the angel of history. There has been here, I think, an extraordinarily far-reaching and provisionally optimistic sense of our expectations for museums. They must address, if not redress, the many endemic ills and ideological blind spots of our lives. When I say we, I would like to think of it as a term of optional inclusion. I have no way of really theorizing that quickly. While we reject any messianic claims for the museum or for the artists therein, we do turn to the museum for redemptive insights. I thought Robert Houlle's exploitation of the dead sound at the center of the dome, was it in the Manitoba legislature? Yeah. Worked as a brilliant metaphor of standing in the museum as an ideology-free place. What is the museum to do or be in the face of genocide, diaspora, corporate vandalism, famine, AIDS, chemical contamination, and so on? Trauma brings on the uncanny recurrence, symptomatic substitutions and repetitions. I think these strange recurrences that are symptoms of the death drive may inform the metaphor of context, historical context, as something nested and layered. So here I'd like to invoke the trauma at the heart of our disciplinary habits. The layered concept of, as described by Foucault, the heterotopia, the countersite that exists outside of all places in which society isolates crises or deviants. A heterotopia may juxtapose within its single real space several sites that are in themselves incompatible. I've argued elsewhere that Vera Frankl's website, The Body Missing, and her transit bar, which delicately, The Body Missing delicately deals with Nazi art theft and thus obliquely with the murder of European Jewry, I've argued that this draws attention to the heterotopic aspects of the museum in which it's situated, as does her diasporic transit bar. So I had a list of heterotopic metaphors that I think might be drawn out of our symposium that point to our ethical expectations and also our fears concerning the museum. It is a Protean-Deleuzian rhizome, which is, as far as I can envision it, part potato and part Mobius strip. It's an archive, catalog, website, zoo, intensive care unit, mortuary, standard achievement test, goofy golf course that requires us to wander around a predetermined course with a miniature famous world monument at each hole, a labyrinth, a laboratory, a bunker, a book, illustrated lecture, shopping mall, singles club, collectors club, fetishist club, parliamentary democracy, although not yet with rep by pop, representation by population, a license office, something that does not exist in a vacuum, but does sometimes create a vacuum, a utopian imagined golden age, a dystopia, a storehouse of the remaining evidence of terrible thefts and diasporas, an imagined respite, a lost homeland, an open door policy mother, a law of the father. And responding to the metaphor of the exploding museum, the museum as official bomb disposal unit, carrying out contained explosions in order to keep the populace safe. And finally, believe it or not, this is a point 12. Griselda Pollock's timely reminder that Marot's museum without walls was in fact not without walls, but rather imaginary in the head, raises our current cultural preoccupation, our here, Europe, the Americas, cultural preoccupation with the museum with walls, that is, the symbolic architecture of museums, which is right now particularly pertinent in Toronto, where we have the specter of new museums or superadded shells to museums to be designed by stars such as Frank Gehry or Daniel Libeskind. It's rather interesting that the museum as visionary architecture seems, in the case of the Tate Modern, which isn't in Toronto, of course, to embody Benjamin's allegorical industrial ruin or fossil. Elsewhere, the envisioned new museums realized in Bilbao are like giant carapaces or conch shells in which we hear not the sound of the sea, but of ourselves sailing, discussing these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. By way of provocation, I might just say that this panel has gloriously not worked for the following reasons. While Elizabeth was talking, I sent a note to each of the panelists who weren't speaking to ask whether or not they had questions of their fellow panelists. Warren, no. Joan, no. Dot, no. Bruce, no. Now, Warren hedged his bets, which tells me he wants to be a director of a major institution, and he hedged his bets by saying, a no doesn't preclude a yes. That's what he sort of whispered in my ear, okay? So so something, anyway, you'll help me, won't you?